Before we dive into another episode, I want to invite you to our first event, February 17th at Lemon, Nani Loa and the End of Tiki. Featuring two distinguished guests, we will record both of those episodes live and then dive into a full-blown pop-up featuring Jeff Tate. Seating is limited, but you can snag your tickets on our website, balancedhospitality.com, or just check us out on Instagram at balancedhospitality. It is my great pleasure to welcome to the Lemon stage, Mike, the ramen lord, the owner of Akahoshi Ramen. If you haven't gotten a seat, it's not your fault. Everyone wants to eat there. Come on up, Mike. So, please, I'd love to get to know you a little bit better for them. Can you tell us about who you are, where you're at?
Yes, and we're going to pretend like you and I don't know each other.
I've never met you in my life.
So my name is Mike Satinover. I am the chef, owner, executive dishwasher of Akahoshi Ramen here in Chicago. We've been open for a little over a year, but I've been making ramen not professionally for 14 years, just as a hobbyist and obsessive, if you will. So the entire restaurant is predicated on me just liking ramen to a gross obsessive degree, but now we get to share it with everybody here in Chicago, and it's been pretty fun so far.
You got started as a hobbyist, you said. What drew you to ramen? What was the impetus? Was it just a good bowl, or had you always loved Japanese cuisine?
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated history in that I have been studying Japan and Japanese culture since I was in, like, high school. I majored in Japanese in college. I lived abroad for a year in Hokkaido. And really, it was a confluence of that with a predisposition towards food and cooking, where I had originally wanted to be a chef and then left the industry for a while. And I think in general, there's a confluence of three things. The first is infatuation with Japan and Japanese culture. The second is this infatuation with food and cooking, and more specifically, approachable disposition food, which ramen certainly is. It's different from, say, fine dining, which I didn't feel like resonated with me personally. And third was just, I hate to say exoticism, but there is a certain exoticism of Japanese culture versus more Western culture that I found very interesting, particularly as I was studying it. Mm-hmm. And so after just kind of all those things while living in Japan and being a broke college student, you kind of gravitate towards ramen.
Yeah.
So I wasn't even planning on making it. I was just eating ramen all the time. I was eating ramen like every day because it was super cheap and I was broke and I was in a city that had a lot of it. So it really happened after I left Japan and came back to the United States and just had this, I guess, nostalgia, immediate urgent nostalgia to continue that lifestyle, as it were. And the only way to do it at the time, because I was living in like Wisconsin where there were no Japanese people whatsoever, was like to make it myself, which was a terrible idea at the time, but has since blossomed into what this is now. Yeah. It was just this desire to re-experience things that I had been experiencing with alarming regularity while living in Japan.
And, I mean, you took to Reddit and you documented so much of it. How has that social media platform kind of shaped your trajectory? Like, did it influence you? Did you influence it? Or how did that go?
I don't know. I don't know if I have the cockiness to say I influenced it.
I don't know. I might say it for you.
I would say so towards the end of living in Hokkaido, I got so into ramen that I made it an independent study, and I was like visiting shops and interviewing these chefs in Japan. And I speak Japanese, but my Japanese is not good enough to beg them to let me visit their restaurants. Ramen is admittedly quite secretive. In fact, many times when I was asking them if I could come in and take an afternoon or take an hour or two even just to talk to them, they would just flat out reject me. I remember in several instances writing these very like methodic letters, and the way you write letters in Japanese often includes like a very set structure and like studying the structure to make sure it was perfect. And then immediately, like a day later, getting dismissed by a chef being like, no, go away. Towards the end of this, I was talking to a chef in Sapporo who owned a still pretty prolific ramen shop at the time. And he mentioned to me how he had no secrets, which I found remarkable because most of the chefs insisted on not telling me something. whether it was like how the soup was made or how the noodle was made or how like certain seasoning components were made, there was always like a little piece that they were like, I can't tell you. But this individual said, you know, wholeheartedly he wouldn't. I found that so refreshing that mm-hmm. when I came back, it just felt like as a visitor of this culture, it didn't make sense for me to gatekeep anything that I would learn. If anything, it felt more like I had an obligation to show everything that I had learned and to give as much credit to any person who helped me get there as possible. So at the time, I didn't really have a platform for this. I didn't have like an Instagram account. Social media at the time, this is like early 2010, 2012 or so. So social media was still kind of in its infancy, and sharing things like this was sort of esoteric, I guess. So Reddit just seemed like the place to do it. I kind of joined it on a whim, not really thinking much of it. Mm-hmm. I just tried to share everything that I was learning, give as much credit as possible. Again, it was not mine to own, it felt like. And I felt like if a chef in Japan could do it, then certainly it made sense for the white guy who was visiting this culture to do it as well. And it was well received. That was kind of the part that was a little unexpected. I think because this dish is often obfuscated in secrecy, given its sort of just inherently cooking often is obfuscated in secrecy. Like chefs always have like their secret ingredient. And we can explain why sometimes it's secret. Sometimes there's a little bit of a dark underbelly as to why it's secret. But it felt very refreshing, I think, to a lot of people to see like, oh, that's like what a tare is. Or like, this is why you can't make noodles at home easily, because there's like all these things going on. It's very complicated. So just peeling back that layer, I think people found enjoyable. And that only propagated me to do it more. It was like a kind of a hedonistic feedback loop where I would do something and people thought it was cool and they gave me cool feedback. And I was like, oh, I gotta do it again. So then I did it again and again and again for like 10 years.
In that journey of learning how to perfect your bowl of ramen, what do you think were the biggest like aha moments of like, oh, I've reached another level?
Yeah. Well, I would say that noodle was probably the biggest. So ramen noodles are very difficult to make. Historically, this noodle doesn't even become prolific in Japan until like World War II, after World War II. The history of this is that wheat noodles are a thing in Japan, but wheat is not really a consumed ingredient in Japanese food at large, certainly not compared to like rice or something. Mm-hmm. After World War II, the United States starts dumping off wheat to Japan as a means of economic restoration. And they don't know what to do with it because nobody has ovens in their houses. So they start making noodles. But it's really prolific in industrial scale where they can make noodles on the cheap. So ramen noodles become popular through industrialization, not through home cooks making it. So what that means is it's hard to make it at home.
Yeah.
So you got to like finagle some stuff to do that. And me finagling some stuff at home to make it more approachable at home while still getting the result that I had grown used to in Japan, there was definitely an aha moment there of like, oh, you can actually make this noodle with some subtle tweaks that are important. And that took a long time. That took like 5 years, frankly, of just like trying and failing and trying and failing and understanding what was happening scientifically in the noodle and understanding chemically what was happening in the noodle and understanding what tools you could and couldn't use at your house versus a giant manufacturer who has much more impressive technology. So the noodle was definitely a big part of it. The second was the introduction of what folks in the ramen culture called aroma oil, which is like one of the five main components that no one talks about. But it's basically an oil that's been infused with some sort of aromatic compound. Onion, garlic, ginger, they're common, but they can it's wildly variant, of course. And no one talked about this ever in any of the English literature, not even in the Japanese literature that I was looking at. Even the chefs I spoke to didn't. And some of that's because in Hokkaido, at least, they used like very simple ones that they didn't even bother mentioning to me when I was talking to them about it. They were just like, oh, whatever, it's lard.
Yeah. Right?
So identifying what that meant for the dish and how to do that and how to make it and how to use it was very powerful as well, in a sort of like secretive way that every chef was doing it, but no one was talking about it. It just sort of existed in their process, basically. It's kind of interesting, in retrospect, thinking about the way that these chefs make ramen in Japan, a lot of the time they just do it because that's what they've been taught to do, and it doesn't even cross their mind that this is a unique or kind of distinctly ramen-esque approach to cooking. Mm-hmm. And so you know, as an outsider, I had to relearn all of that and understand the why as well.
Yeah. And it is a dish that has become globalized as well. So
yes.
There is this sense of like, okay, there's the traditional way to do it, and then people have to innovate upon that basic tradition of,
yes.
And it's a recent thing, as you said. So how do you balance those things in your own shop?
For a long time, I didn't balance it. I tried to hit the traditional stuff as closely as possible. Yeah. So like if you look at our menu today, the main dish is called the Akahoshi Miso, and that is like as extremely close to a Sapporo style miso as I can make it. Like there are some minor tweaks that I've made just out of personal preference, but I literally built the shop knowing how this dish was invented and propagated and then tried to make it as close to that style as possible. And that will be on the restaurant menu forever, basically.
Yeah.
That's also the dish that I fell in love with because I lived in Sapporo. So that was kind of like eating. It was like if you lived in Chicago and ate Italian beefs all day. So then you just grew to love Italian beef. And then you were making Johnny's style Italian beef forever. I was making Sapporo style miso ramen. Specifically, like, there's a couple shops that I like really, really loved that I was really trying to replicate. A lot of the menu at least started off just being like replication. How can I make this dish that I've just grown so accustomed to and recreate it in a way? The only reason I started branching out was because I felt like I just wanted to grow my knowledge, and there was only a way to grow your knowledge beyond what was written out or what I had learned in Japan, that was to try experimenting and just see what worked. But I often still, to this day, if you look at our menu, you'll see that we make styles from certain regions of Japan. This month is an example. We have a special. We rotate a special every month. This month is a special called Akayu Spicy Miso. It is a very specific style of ramen. It comes out in around the early mid-60s in the Yamagata Prefecture of Japan. I spent years researching how this thing is made because it's really predominantly made by one shop called Ryu Shanhai. And they are very secretive. One ramen chef friend of mine said, oh, don't tell anybody about how this is made. It might be connected to the mob because there's a lot of Yakuza in the Yamagata Prefecture. I don't know if that's true or not, but there's immense secrecy, right? They don't want you to know. Some of that, who knows why?
Yeah.
But I spent a long time looking through, like, I was literally looking at, like package versions of this because, like, the brand is very popular in Japan, or very large in Japan, and so they'll make like packaged versions of their ramen that you can take home. And so it has an ingredient list. So I would like scour the ingredient list and like look at the, oh, this one comes before this one, so there must be more of this ingredient than that one. Or, oh, this package one is different than that package one, so like which one is more realistic to the actual one? All this is to say, I still had to actually try the dish as well from Ryu Shanhai, and so that helped too, is like going back to Japan and actually eating this dish and seeing those flavors and seeing how this thing was presented. But I spent a long time trying to figure this dish out. It's kind of what I'm trying to tell you. And also, more importantly, understand why the dish came to prevalence and understand why the components were as they were. So the story of this dish, it's kind of weird because it's directly juxtaposed to miso ramen in Hokkaido. In Hokkaido, they say they invented miso ramen. In Yamagata, they say they invented miso ramen. They both, like, I don't know. Who knows who's right? It's sort of folklore. But understanding how this dish got kind of serendipitously made only helped me understand how to make it more aligned to the style. And that is an approach I take regularly when I'm trying to make someone else's ramen, because it's not my ramen. This is a Yamagata-style ramen. And I want to convey that to anybody who eats it. I think, frankly, that's often missing in the ramen landscape outside of Japan. It's like, what is this thing? It just exists kind of in its own bubble as like, it's a noodle soup dish and that's what it is. But there's so much nuance and depth in the types of ramen that exist across Japan. And we try and convey that every time we put a special out that is hitting on a particular subgenre or a particular style from a particular region. And so I just spend a lot of time researching and trying and thinking about like what the components are.
And that's just one half of getting a restaurant going.
Yeah.
You have come into this from left field and done it in a different way. What things have you learned in that journey?
Yeah, I mean, my path is not traditional at all.
Yeah.
Right. I didn't work under a chef, didn't work in, I mean, ramen's a little avant-garde compared to a lot of traditional Japanese cooking genres, you know, certainly because its lineage is less long. I remember I was interviewing the son of the inventor of miso ramen in Hokkaido. Mm-hmm. And I kept telling him, like, oh, the culture of ramen. What about the culture of ramen? And he, like, interrupted me. He was like, stop. There's no ramen culture. Ramen is too young to have culture.
Yeah.
He's like, think about the culture in Japan. It's like 2,000-year-old country. You think ramen has culture? It's 70 years old, right? It's like it has some history. He said, we have ramen history, but we do not have ramen culture. And what that meant, at least to me, at least the way I interpreted it at the time, given that he said this all in Japanese, it's a little fuzzy for me now. But the interpretation I had of this was the dish doesn't have some of these preconceptions that a lot of other cooking in Japan has. Sushi is an example. You know, its most recent evolution is like Meiji era updates, which is like 120 years ago. Ramen doesn't even exist 120 years ago. It's borderline unheard of until 1910. So what that means is that chefs are more experimentative and they don't follow the same mm-hmm. or the more classic sort of apprenticeship pathway that you would see in learning the dish. Frequently, at least, a ramen cook will work at a shop for maybe a couple of years only before opening up his or her own place. That's unheard of in other systems or other kind of traditional pathways. It follows some similarity in that you see specialization. It's rare for a chef in Japan to do ramen and sushi and tempura and, you know, all these other types of cooking. You're a ramen cook, fundamentally. Mm-hmm. And you follow, I guess, what they would call the craftsman or shokunin style of learning, but it's faster. You know, a chef who's learning sushi might learn for 10 years under one person before going to do their own thing.
And they're only allowed to touch, like, the rice.
Yeah, for, like, years. Yeah. Whereas, like, a ramen cook, it's a lot faster. There's not as many guardrails. But that's also because there's a lot less rules. So mm-hmm. there's more things that an individual can do. So my path didn't follow any of that. But it probably wouldn't have been as crazy anyway because it's ramen. And so there isn't as much of that context holding it all together. And experimentation and iteration are more revered in the ramen landscape compared to other genres of Japanese cooking or other styles of Japanese cooking. But that being said, I had a lot to learn. I mean, open a restaurant. Restaurants are hard. You know, having worked in restaurants for a while, they're difficult places to work.
They're all right.
I mean, to be clear, I'm so glad I opened my restaurant. It is the greatest thing I've ever done in my life. It is hard, though. Like, it can be both enjoyable and difficult, I guess that's what I would say. For me, I had to learn how to do all the other stuff besides the cooking. I think that restaurants are like 10% cooking. It's like 90% other stuff.
Yeah.
Like the toilet breaks, you got to fix the toilet. Or the HVAC goes down, and so you got to call somebody up at 8 p.m. Or the cooler stops working, so you got to move everything to the other cooler and hope that you can fix the cooler quickly. Or somebody calls off, and you got to make sure you get coverage. Like, restaurants are like 10% cooking. I like all of it, though, honestly. But I had to learn to do the 90%. It wasn't just the 10%.
What in that 90% was the biggest hurdle for you? And what advice would you give
honestly,
to someone?
Honestly, it's stupid stuff like ordering. Like, I don't know if people realize this, but you need to, like, have a whole system of ordering and buying and inventory management. And when you're a home cook, you go to the store, you buy the stuff, you cook the stuff, you're done. When you're a restaurant, you got to think about all the pieces of when things get prepared and sold mm-hmm. and having all that stuff so you don't miss out on being able to provide something to a guest. Because it's like a huge bummer when you run out of something. Like, I feel so bad if we ever run out of anything. We used to. Yeah. We don't anymore, but we used to. So learning that was definitely challenging. I mean, and it's harder than a Japanese ramen shop that often has a tighter menu. Our menu is a little more widespread. It's not as crazy as other restaurants in Chicago, but it's certainly more difficult than a ramen shop that has one dish, which is more common in Japan.
So you're a year in, you've learned a lot of these different things, and I would wonder what cultural hallmarks have you found for your shop? What anchors it and sets it apart?
Well, I think we retain the same ethos at our shop of that we have no secrets. Like, I've been very clear to everybody about that in a couple ways. One, I frequently allow stages from anywhere to come in and hang out with us and learn how we make everything. I have this free ebook out that has all of the recipes that we have ever made ever for free that anyone can look at ever. So if you hate my guts, which like I don't think many people do, but some people do, and they don't want to support me in any way, they can steal my recipes and open a ramen shop. It's fine.
Where did you put that?
That's on Google Docs. It's just like in my, it's a link in my Instagram bio. It's free for anybody to access.
That's so nice of you.
Again, it's not mine, right? Yeah. Like the ramen is not mine. But what I've learned potentially can help other people, and it's worth sharing that with other people. So we have a strong ethos of education and a strong ethos of kind of transparency in the work that we do. So, you know, I've had maybe 8-10 people in the last year come in and just hang out and watch what we do, come on the line, make some ramen with us, see how the noodles get made. We don't have a lot of secrets. As I've grown, I realize that some of that is because shops that have secrets often have some weird stuff they don't want to tell you, like that they don't make the soup, they don't make certain things, they just buy it. But we make everything. We're really proud of what we make. So I want people to understand the work that goes into it, and I'm happy to share as much or as little detail about that with anybody who wants to hear. And so education continues to be a big part of the growth or the part of our work. Mm-hmm. The other, which I think is more traditionally Japanese, is this idea of Kaizen or continuous improvement. We have had many guests who have come in this year versus last year and said, wow, ramen is so much better now than it was last year, which maybe that means our ramen sucked last year. I don't know. But our team is, and I are very fundamentally believer. We fundamentally believe in this idea of making things better and being willing to make steps to improve things continuously. We're not really satisfied with just like, it's good, it's done, right? It's like, can we make it better? Is there a better process? That's fundamentally quite Japanese, as far as I can tell. Certainly you see this kind of across not just Japanese chefs, but across Japanese companies broadly, this idea of continuous improvement. And we take that pretty seriously too. I make sure that my team knows loud and clear that if they have hear anything or they want to improve anything, that they tell me and we figure out ways to make it better. Because that's what makes our learning and makes our development as a restaurant and as a person who is a craftsman myself, it's how I get to connect with the dish more. So that part of Japanese culture is very deeply instilled in our restaurant, for sure.
Would you say that there are some things that you look for when you go out and have a bowl of ramen? When I met you, you were like, I went to Japan, I had like 1,000 bowls of ramen, and now I'm back. What were the things that stood out to you and that you would share with someone who wants to get into making ramen?
If you want to make ramen?
Yeah, like, these are the things I loved about it. This is why you should make ramen that way.
That's a tough one. I mean, ramen is a strange dish in that it's a fast food in Japan. So shortcuts and easy component making is common. It's like when you go to a burger shop, how many places make the bun? Do you know what I mean? Like you could, but not many are going to do that. How many people are grinding their own meat for the patty? You could, but a lot aren't. In America, I think we think of ramen as like, oh, of course you'd make all the components. But in Japan, more often than not, they're not, because it's a fast food and it needs to be a certain price. You know, for us, I think the ramen that I like the most is the stuff where every component has been meticulously thought about. If you look at our menu today as an example, we have 5 dishes, 4 of which have their own noodle, a separate noodle for each dish. That's an intentional choice. It's a lot more work. It takes a lot more planning and a lot more thought and a lot more. It's difficult on the line, it's difficult in the prep, it's difficult across the entirety of that dish's existence on our menu, but I think it makes a better product. And that's only possible when you make everything. Otherwise, you're beholden to whatever the producer of the component is doing. So my favorite shops try as close to do that as possible. They're making as much stuff as possible. The only way to find that out is if they tell you. Sometimes they won't, and that's because most of the time they're not. So it's hard to find these shops that kind of make the ramen that kind of resonate with me. But to be fair, it's hard to find those in Japan, too.
I want to thank you for coming on and hanging out. I'd love to know how it's going now that
honestly, it's like so busy. It's insane. It's crazy. So I guess people like it because it's been going pretty well. I'm very happy. You know, there's a couple points of pride that I have. Namely, one, we've had like no turnover since we opened. I think I've lost 2 staff members in a year.
Wow.
Out of 15 people. I think we have a really strong team of people that have shared this desire to make this certain food a certain way. and we work well together. And it seems like ultimately Chicago, far and away, likes what we're doing, which is pretty cool. Considering how much work I put in, it is very validating to feel that way. And we retain our kind of busyness and our buzz. So ultimately, I would say it is rare, I think, for a restaurateur with no experience, no less, to open a place to have it be popular. But it is great that it has retained, you know, people have still retained their interest in space. And I look forward to continuing to make lots of crazy ramen throughout the next however long we're open.
Before we dive into another episode, I want to invite you to our first event, February 17th at Lemon, Nani Loa and the End of Tiki. Featuring two distinguished guests, we will record both of those episodes live and then dive into a full-blown pop-up featuring Jeff Tate. Seating is limited, but you can snag your tickets on our website, balancedhospitality.com, or just check us out on Instagram at balancedhospitality.